And I've killed the security system permanently. No need for it. Just an accident waiting to happen when one of you monkeys sticks a finger where it doesn't belong. Is this Ashford cocksucker really thinking he can hurt the gates? And there are worlds like this one on the other side of all those gates? Some of them, maybe. Who knows? Miller turned to face Holden again, his blue eyes eerie and full of secrets. Someone fought a war here, kid. One that spanned this galaxy and maybe more. My team lost, and they're all gone now. A couple billion years gone. Who knows what's waiting on the other side of those doors? We'll find out, I guess, Holden replied, putting on a bold front but frightened in spite of himself. Doors and corners, Miller said again. Something in his voice told Holden it was the last warning. They looked up at the sky, watching the ship slowly drift away from them. Holden waited to see the first missiles fly, but it didn't happen. Everyone was playing nice. Maybe what had happened on the behemoth had changed people. Maybe they'd take that change back to where they came from, infect others with it. It was a lot to hope for, but Holden was an unapologetic optimist. Give people the information they need. Trust them to do the right thing. He didn't know any other way to play it. Or maybe the ship's moving was just Miller playing with his simulation, and humanity hadn't learned a thing. So, Holden said after a few minutes of quiet sky watching, thanks for the visit. I guess I'd better be getting back to my gunfight. Not done with you, Miller said. The tone was light, but the words were ominous. Okay. I wasn't built to fix shit humanity broke, Miller said. I didn't come here to open gates for you and get the lockdown to let you go. That's incidental. The thing that made me just builds roads. And now it's using me to find out what happened to the galaxy-spanning civilization that wanted the road. Why does that matter now, if they're all gone? It doesn't, Miller said with a weary shrug. Not a bit. If you set the nav computer on the Rosi to take you somewhere and then fall over dead a second later, can the Rosi decide it doesn't matter anymore and just not go? No, Holden said, understanding and finding a sadness for this Miller construct he wouldn't have guessed was possible. We were supposed to connect with the network. We're just trying to do that. Doesn't matter that the network's gone. What came up off of Venus is dumb, kid. Just knows how to do one thing. It doesn't know how to investigate, but I do. And it had me. So I'm going to investigate, even though none of the answers will mean fuck all to the universe at large. I understand, Holden said. Good luck, Miller. I said I'm not done with you. Holden took a step back, suddenly very frightened about where this might be going. What does that mean? It means, kid, that I'll need a ride. Holden was floating in free fall in an environment suit in absolute darkness. People were yelling. There was the sound of a gunshot, then silence, then an electric pop and a groan. Stop! Someone yelled. Holden couldn't place the voice. Everyone stop shooting! Because someone was saying it with authority in their voice, people did. Holden fumbled with the controls on his wrist, and his suit's light came on. The rest of his team quickly followed his example. Corin and Cass were still unhurt. Holden wondered how long in actual time his jaunt into the simulation had taken. My name is Hector Cortez, the stop-firing voice said. What's happening out there? Does anyone know? It's over, Holden yelled back, then let his body relax into a dead man's float in the corridor. He was so tired that it was a struggle to not just go to sleep right where he was. It's all over. You can turn everything back on. Lights started coming on in the bridge as people took out hand terminals or emergency flashlights. Call Ruiz, Cortez said. Have her send a team up here to fix whatever Clarissa did. We need to get the ship's power back. People will be panicking in the habitation drum right now. And get a medical team up here. Holden wondered where Ashford was and why this Cortez guy was in charge. But he was saying all the right things, so Holden let it go. He pushed his way into the bridge, ready to help where he could, but keeping his hand near his pistol. Cass and Naomi traded places with Juarez so Naomi could help with the repairs. Clarissa, formerly Melba, was floating near an open access panel, blood seeping out of a gunshot wound. Cortez was pressing an emergency bandage to it. Ashford floated across the room, his mouth slack and his muscles twitching. Holden wondered if the captain was dead, and then didn't care. Naomi, call down to the radio offices, see if they've got working comms. Find out about Anna and Monica and Amos. Try to raise the Rossi next. I really, really want to get the hell out of here. She nodded and started trying to make connections. Will she live? Holden asked the white-haired man tending to her. I think so, he replied. She did this, he added, waving a hand around to indicate the lack of lights and power. Huh, Holden said. I guess I'm glad we didn't space her. Chapter 53. Clarissa. She woke up in stages, aware of the discomfort before she knew what hurt, aware that something was wrong before she could even begin to put together some kind of story, some frame that gave the loose, rattling toolbox of sensations any kind of meaning. Even when the most abstract parts of herself returned, her name, where she was, Clarissa was mostly aware that she was compromised, that something was wrong with her. The room was dirty, the air a few degrees too hot. She lay in the thin, sweat-stinking bed, an IV drip hanging above her. The significance of that took a long time to come to her. The bag hung there. She wasn't floating. There was gravity. She didn't know if it was spin or thrust, or even the calm pull of mass against mass that being on a planet brought. She didn't have the context to know, only that it was nice to have weight again. It meant that something had gone right. Something was working. When she closed her eyes, she dreamed that she had killed Ren, that she'd hidden him inside her own body so she had to keep anyone from taking an imaging scan for fear they'd find him in her. It was a pleasure to wake up and remember that everyone already knew. Sometimes Tilly came, sat by her bed. She looked like she'd been crying. Clarissa wanted to ask what was wrong, but she didn't have the strength. Sometimes Anna was there. The doctor who checked on her was a beautiful old woman with eyes that had seen everything. Cortez never came. Sleeping and waking lost their edges, healing and being ill too. It was difficult, if not impossible, to draw a line between them. She woke once to voices, to the hated voice, to Holden. He was standing at the foot of her bed, his arms crossed on his chest. Naomi was next to him, and then the others. The pale one who looked like a truck driver, the brown one who looked like a school teacher, Amos and Alex, the crew of the Rocinante, the people she hadn't managed to kill. She was glad to see them. There is absolutely no way, Holden said. Look at her, Anna said. Clarissa craned her neck to see the woman standing behind her. The priest looked older, worn out, or maybe distilled, cooked down to something like her essence. She was beautiful, too. Beautiful and terrible and uncompromising in her compassion. It was in her face. It made her hard to look at. She'll be killed. Alex, the schoolteacher, raised his hand.
You mean she'll be tried in a court of law with a lawyer for killing a bunch of folks that we all pretty much know she killed?
I did, Clarissa thought. It's true. Above her, Anna pressed her hands together. I mean, that's what I want to happen, Anna said. A trial. Lawyers. Justice. But I need someone to get her safely from here to the Corson Luna. With the evacuation starting, you have the only independent ship in the slow zone. You are the only crew that I trust to get her out safely. Naomi looked over at Holden. Clarissa couldn't read the woman's expression. I'm not taking her on my ship, Holden said. She tried to kill us. She almost did kill Naomi. She also saved you both, Anna said, and everybody else.
I'm not sure being a decent human that one time means I owe her something, Holden said.
I'm not saying it does, Anna said. But if we don't treat her with the same sense of justice that we'd ask for ourselves...
Look, Red, Amos said. Everybody in this room, except maybe you and the captain, has a flexible sense of morality. None of us got clean hands. That's not the point. This is a tactical thing, Alex agreed.
It is, Holden said. It is, Naomi said. Pretend that she's not a danger in and of herself. Taking her on board, even just to transport her to a safe place, puts us at risk from three different legal systems. And our situation is already... tenuous is a nice word. Clarissa reached up, took Anna's shirt between her fingers, tugging like a child at her mother. It's okay, she croaked. I understand. It's all right. How much? Anna asked. And then, off their blank looks, if it's just risk versus return, how much would it take to be worth it to you?
More than you have, Holden said.
But there was an apology in his tone. He didn't want to disappoint Anna, and he didn't want to do what she said. No way for him to win. What if I bought the Rocinante? Anna said.
It's not for sale, Holden said.
Not from you. I know about your legal troubles. What if I bought the Rocinante from Mars? Gave you the rights to it. Free and clear.
You're going to buy a warship? Alex said. Do churches get to do that?
Sure, Holden said. Do that and I'll smuggle her out.
Anna held up a finger, then pulled her hand terminal out of her pocket. Clarissa could see her hands were trembling. She tapped at the screen, and a few seconds later a familiar voice came from the box. Annie, Tilly Fagan said, where are you? I'm having cocktails with half a dozen very important people, and they're boring me to tears. The least you can do is come up and let them fawn over you for a while. Tilly, Anna said, you remember that really expensive favor you owe me? I know what it is.
I'm all ears, Tilly said.
I need you to buy the Rocinante from Mars and give it to Captain Holden. Tilly was silent. Clarissa could practically see the woman's eyebrows rising. It's the only way to take care of Clarissa. Tilly's exhalation could have been a sigh or laughter.
Sure. What the hell? I'll tell Robert to do it.
He will.
It'll be less than I'd get in a divorce.
Anything else, dear? Shall I change the Earth's orbit for you while I'm at it?
No, Anna said. That's plenty.
You're damn right it is. Get up here soon. Really, everyone's swooning over you. And it'll be much more amusing for me to watch them try to squeeze up next to you in person. I will, Anna said. She put her hand terminal back in her pocket and took Clarissa's hand in her own. Her fingers were warm. Well? Holden's face had gone pale. He looked from Clarissa to Anna and back, and blew out a long breath. He said.
Wow. Okay. We may not be going home right away, though. Is that cool?
Clarissa held out her hand, astounded by its weight. It took them all a moment to understand what she was doing. Then Holden, the man she'd moved heaven and earth to humiliate and murder, took her hand.
Pleased to meet you, she croaked.
They installed a medical restraint cuff to her ankle, set to sedate her on a signal from any of the crew, or if it detected any of the products of her artificial glands, or if she left the crew decks of the ship. It was 3 kilos of formed yellow plastic that clung to her leg like a barnacle. The transfer came during the memorial service. Captain Michio Pa, her face still bandaged from the fighting, spoke in glowing terms about Carlos Baca and Samantha Rosenberg and a dozen other names, and commended their ashes to the void. Then each of the commanders of the other ships in the flotilla took their turns, standing before the cameras on the decks of their own ships, speaking a few words, moving on. No one mentioned Ashford, locked away and sedated. No one mentioned her. It was the last ceremony before the exodus, before the return. Clarissa watched it on her hand terminal when she wasn't looking at the screen that showed the shuttle's exterior view. The alien station was inert now. It didn't glow, didn't react, didn't read to the sensors as anything more than a huge slug of mixed metals and carbonate structures floating in a starless void.
They're not all going back, you know, Alex said. The Martian team is planning to stay here. Run surveys on all the gates. See what's on the other side.
I didn't know that, Clarissa said.
Yeah, this right now,
the pilot said, gesturing toward the screen where a UN captain was speaking earnestly into the camera, her eyes hard as marbles and her jaw set against the sorrow of listing the names of the dead.
This is the still point. Before, this was all fear. After this, it'll all be greed. But this, he sighed, well, it's a nice moment anyway.
It is, Clarissa said.
So, just to check, are you still planning to kill the captain? Because, you know, if you are, it seems like you at least owe us a warning.
I'm not, she said.
And if you were?
I'd still say I wasn't. But I'm not.
Fair enough.
Okay, Alex, Holden said from the back. Are we there yet?
Just about to knock, Alex said.
He tapped on the control panel, and on the screen, the Rocinante's exterior lights came on. The ship glowed gold and silver in the blackness, like seeing a whole city from above.
Okay, folks, we're home.
Clarissa's bunk was larger than her quarters in the Cerisier, smaller than the one from the Prince. She wasn't sharing it with anyone, though. It was hers, as much as anything was. All she had for clothing was a jumpsuit with the name Tachi imprinted in the weave. All her toiletries were the standard ship issue. Nothing was hers. Nothing was her. She kept to her room, going out to the galley and the head when she needed to. It wasn't fear, exactly, so much as the sense of wanting to stay out of the way. It wasn't her ship. It was theirs. She wasn't one of them, and she didn't deserve to be. She was a paid passenger, and not a fare they'd even wanted. The awareness of that weighed on her. Over time, the bunk began to feel more like her cell in the behemoth than anything else. That was enough to drive her out a little. Only a little, though. She'd seen the galley before in simulations, when she'd been planning how to destroy it, where to place her override. It looked different in person. Not smaller or larger exactly, but different. The crew moved through the space, going from one place to another, passing through in the way she couldn't. They ate their meals and had their meetings, ignoring her like she was a ghost, like she'd already lost her place in the world. "Well," Holden said, his voice grim, "we have a major problem. We're out of coffee." "We still got beer," Amos said. "Yes," Holden said, "but beer is not coffee. I've put in a request with the behemoth, but I haven't heard back, and I can't see going into the vast and unknown void without coffee." Alex looked over at Clarissa and grinned. "The captain doesn't like the fake coffee the Rosie makes," he said. "Gives him gas." Clarissa didn't answer. She wasn't sure she was supposed to. "It does not," Holden said. "That was one time." "More than once, Captain," Amos said. "And no offense, but it does smell like a squirrel crawled up your ass and died there." "Okay," Holden said. "You've got no room to complain. As I recall, I was the one who cleaned your bunk after that experiment with vodka goulash."
"He's got a point," Alex said. "That was damn nasty. I just about shat out my intestinal lining, that's true," Amos said, his expression philosophical. "But I'd still put that against the captain's coffee farts."
Alex made a fake gagging noise, and Amos buzzed his lips against his palm, making a rude sound. Naomi looked from one to the other like she didn't know whether to laugh or smack them. "I don't get gas," Holden said. "I just like the taste of real coffee better." Naomi put her hand on Clarissa's forearm and leaned close. Her smile was gentle and unexpected. "Have I mentioned how nice it is to have another woman on the ship?" she asked. It was a joke. Clarissa understood that. But it was a joke that included her, and her tears surprised her.
"I appreciate your saying all that about Bull," a man's voice said.
Clarissa, moving through the ship, didn't recognize it. An unfamiliar voice in a spaceship caught the attention like a strange sound in her bedroom. She paused.
"It was a friend for a lot of years, and I'll miss him."
She shifted, angled back toward the other crew cabins. Holden's door was open, and he sat in his crash couch, looking up at his monitor. Instead of the tactical display of the ships, the stations, the rings, a man's face dominated the screen. She recognized Fred Johnson, traitor to Earth and head of the Outer Planets Alliance, the butcher of Anderson Station. He looked old, his hair almost all gone to white, and his eyes the yellow color of old ivory.
"I asked a lot from him," the recording went on. "He gave a lot back to me. It got me thinking. I have a bad habit, Captain, of asking more than people can give sometimes, of demanding more than I can fairly expect. I'm wondering if I might have done something like that with you."
"Gee, you think?" Holden said to the screen, though as far as she could see, he wasn't recording.
"If I did, I apologize. Just between us, one commander to another, I regret some of the decisions I've made. I figure you can relate to that in your own way. I've decided to keep the behemoth in place. We're sending out soil and supplies to start farming on the drum. It does mean the OPA's military fleet just lost its big kahuna, but it looks like we've got 1,000 planets opening up for exploration, and having the only gas station on the turnpike is too sweet a position to walk away from. If you and your crew want to help out with the effort, escort some ships from Ganymede out to the ring, there might be a few contracts in it for you. So, that's the official part. Talk about it with the others, and let me know what decisions you come to. Fred Johnson nodded once to the camera, and the screen fell to the blue emptiness and split circle of the OPA's default. Holden looked over his shoulder. She saw him see her.
Hey, she said.
Hey. They were silent for a moment. She didn't know what to say. She wanted to apologize, too, to walk down the path Fred Johnson had just showed her, but she couldn't quite. She waited to see whether Holden would reach out to her. When he didn't, she pulled herself back down toward the crew quarters. Her stomach felt tight and uncomfortable. They weren't friends. They wouldn't be, because some things couldn't be made right. She'd have to be okay with that. Amos smelled of solvent and sweat. Of all the crew, he was the one most like the people she knew, Soledad and Stani and Ren. He came into the galley with a welding rig on, the mask pushed up over his forehead. He smiled when he saw her.
You did a number on the place, Amos said.
She knew that if the occasion arose, he would be perfectly willing to kill her. But until that moment, he'd be jovial and casual. That counted for more than she'd expected.
I mean, you had a salvage mech. Those are pretty much built for peeling steel.
I didn't at the end, she said. It ran out of power. The locker and the airlock was all me.
Really?
He said.
Yeah.
Well, he said, pulling a bulb of the fake coffee from the machine and drifting over to the table. That was pretty impressive then.
She imagined him working, the mask down to hide his face, the sparks, the flickering of his great hunched shadow. Hephaestus, the smith of the gods, laboring in his underworld. It was the kind of association Clarissa Mao would make. Melba Coe would only have thought about the temperature of the arc, the composition of the plates he was fusing together. She could have both of those thoughts, but neither were really hers. She was on the float now. Later, when the ship was underway and thrust gravity pinned her to the deck, she'd still be on the float. Her world had been constructed around stories about who she was. Jules Pierre's daughter, Julie Mao's sister, the crew lead on the Cerisier, instrument of her father's vengeance. Now she was no one. She was a piece of baggage on her old enemy's ship, going from one prison to another, and she didn't even resent it. The last time she'd felt this nameless, she'd probably been in an amniotic sac. What was the problem? You said I really did a number on something. What's the problem?
Deck hatch between the machine shop and here gets stuck. Ever since you crumpled it up. Bind's about half open.
Did you check the retracting arm? Amos turned to her, frowning. She shrugged. Sometimes these door actuators put on an uneven load when they start to burn out. We probably swapped out 4 or 5 of them on the trip out here.
Yeah?
Just a thought, she said. And then a moment later, when we get back to Luna, they're going to kill me, aren't they?
If you're lucky, yeah. UN still has the death penalty on the books, but they don't use it much. I figure you'll be living in a tiny cell for the rest of your life. If it was me, I'd prefer a bullet.
How long until we get there?
About 5 weeks.
They were silent for a moment. I'll miss this place, she said. Amos shrugged.
Actuator arm, huh? Worth checking. You want to help me take a look?
I can't, she said, gesturing at the clamp on her leg.
Shit, I can reprogram that. At least enough to get you down to the machine shop. We'll grab your tool belt, Peaches. Let's crack that thing open.
An hour later, she was running her hand over the frame of the door, looking for the telltale scrape of binding sights. This was me, she thought. I broke it.
What you think, Peaches? Amos asked from behind her.
Feels good to fix something, she said. Epilogue. Anna. Anna sat in the observation lounge of the Thomas Prince and looked out at the stars. The lounge was a dome-shaped room where every flat surface was a high-definition screen displaying a 360-degree view of the outside. To Anna, sitting in it felt like flying through space on a park bench. It had become her favorite place on the ship, with the stars burning in their bright, steady colors, no atmosphere to make them twinkle. They felt so close now, like she could reach out and touch them. Her hand terminal beeped at her to remind her that she was in the middle of recording a video message. She deleted the time she'd spent looking at the stars and started the recording again. So, that letter from the conference bishop turned out to be a request for a formal meeting. Apparently, some people have complained about me. Probably Ashford. Neck deep in his own legal problems with the OPA and still finding time to make trouble for everyone else. But don't worry about it. They'll ask, I'll answer. I've got pretty good reasons for everything I did. I have lots of offers of support from people I worked with on the fleet. I probably won't need them. Speaking of which, I've invited my friend Tilly Fagin to come visit us in Moscow. She's abrasive and cranky, and has no social filters at all. You'll love her. She can't wait to meet Nami. Anna paused to attach a picture she'd taken of Tilly to the message. Tilly was looking at the camera through narrowed eyes, just seconds from telling Anna to get that fucking thing out of my face. She held a cigarette in one hand. Her other was pointing accusingly. It was not the nicest picture of Tilly she had, but it was the most accurate. Speaking of Nami, thank you so much for the videos you sent. I can't believe how enormous she's gotten, and crawling around in full gravity like she was born to it. She'll be walking again in no time. Thank you for taking her home. Sometimes I wish I'd just gone with you. Most of the time, actually. But then I think about all the things I did inside the ring, and I wonder if any of it would have turned out as well if I hadn't helped. It seems arrogant to think that way, but I also believe that God nudges people toward the places they need to be. Maybe I was needed. I still plan on being very contrite when I get back. You, the bishop, Nami, my family. I have a lot of apologizing to do. As clear as if she'd been in the room, Anna heard Nono say, "You never ask for permission. You just apologize later." She laughed until her eyes watered. She wiped them and said to the camera, "You're still here, Nono. Still in my head. But I'd trade anything to have you hold me. The prince will take another month to get back. It's an eternity. I love you." She picked up the pillow she'd brought with her and held it tight to her chest. "This is you and Nami. This is both of you. I love you both so much." She killed the recording and sent it off, winging ahead of the prince to Nono at the speed of light. Still too slow. She wiped away the tears that had accumulated at the corners of her eyes. Outside, a flare of white light lit the sky, a line of fire a few centimeters long. Another ship in the flotilla, returning home. One of the prince's escort ships, to be so close. Finally going back, but without many of the sailors she'd brought to the ring. Families would be waiting for her to bring their loved ones home, only to receive flags, posthumous medals, letters of sympathy. It wouldn't be enough to fill the holes those lost people left in their lives. It was never enough. But the ships from Earth, Mars, and the various stations of the outer planets were going home, and they were bringing news of the greatest opportunity humanity had ever been offered. In the midst of all the sadness and tragedy, hope. Would Nami spend her life at one of those points of light she could see right now? It was possible. Her baby had been born into a world where her parents couldn't afford to give her a sibling, where she'd have to work 2 years just to prove to the government she was worth receiving an education, where resources were rapidly diminishing, and the battle to keep the waste from piling up used more and more of what was left. But she'd grow up in a world without limits, where a short trip took you to one of the stars, and the bounty of worlds circling them. Where what job you did, or what education you pursued, or how many children you had, was your choice, not a government mandate. It was dizzying to think of. Someone walked into the lounge behind her, their footsteps clicking. "Tilly, I just sent..." Anna started, but stopped when she turned around and saw Hector Cortez.
"Dr. Volovodov," he said, his tone a mild apology.
"Dr. Cortez," she replied. The renewed formality between them seemed silly to Anna, but Hector insisted on it. "Please, sit." She patted the bench next to her.
"I hope I'm not disturbing you," he said, sitting and staring out at the stars, not looking at her. He didn't look her in the eye anymore.
"Not at all. Just recording a message home and enjoying the view." They sat silently for a few moments, watching the stars.
"Esteban lost," Cortez said, as if they'd been talking about that all along.
"I don't... Oh, the Secretary General. He did.
Nancy Gao is the new SG. You can see Christian Avasarala's fingerprints all over that one."
"Who?"
Cortez laughed. It sounded genuine. A nice, loud rumble coming up from his belly. "Oh, she would love to hear you say that."
"Who is she?"
"She's the politician no one has ever voted for that runs the UN like her own personal fiefdom and keeps her name out of the press. The fact that she controls your home government and you've never heard of her means she's very, very good."
"Oh," Anna said. She was not a political creature. She felt that politics was the second most evil thing humanity had ever invented, just after Lutefisk. There was another long silence. Anna wondered where Tilly was, and if she'd show up and rescue her from the awkwardness of the moment.
"You backed the right horse," Cortez finally said. "I picked a bad one. I hope you won't hold that against me. I've grown to respect you a great deal, in spite of our differences. I wouldn't like it if you hated me."
"I don't, Hector," Anna said, taking his hand in both of hers and squeezing it. "Not at all. It was terrible, what we all went through. We all made bad decisions because we were afraid. But you're a good man. I believe that." Cortez gave her a grateful smile and patted her hand. Anna nodded her head at the star field splashed across the wall. "So many stars," she said. "Some of them might be ours someday."
"I wonder," Hector replied, his voice low and sad. "I wonder if we should have them. God gave man the earth. They never promised him the stars. I wonder if he'll follow us out there."
Anna squeezed his hand again, and then let it go. "The God I believe in is bigger than all of this. Nothing we ever learn can be an attack on him, as long as that's true. Cortez gave a noncommittal grunt. I want her to have them, she said, pointing at the spray of light around her. My little Nami. I want her to have all of that someday. Whatever she finds out there, Cortez said. Just remember, it's the future you chose for her. His words were full of hope and threat, like the stars. This has been a Hachette audio production of Abaddon's Gate, Book 3 of The Expanse, written by James S.A. Corey, read by Jefferson Mays. Produced and directed by Dennis Kao. Sound edited by Sean Bolter and Ian Lehman. Mixing and mastering by Jeremy Wesley. Production supervised by Elise Green. Abaddon's Gate is also available in print and digital formats from Orbit, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2013 by James S.A. Corey. Audio production copyright 2018 Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this book without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from this book other than for review purposes, please contact permissions at hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events or locales, is entirely coincidental.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.